people of Appalachia have been dissed and dispossessed, but they've always resisted and still are.
The people of Appalachia are not placid. They are not inert, and they are, many of them, activists. I've met them. They're extraordinarily well-informed and well-organized, and they intend to try to take that environment back, to get restitution from the coal companies, and even get the land back from them in some cases. So we've not heard the end of this, and the end of the story is not the destruction of West Virginia. The end of the story has not been written.
That's Stephen Stoll. We talk with him about his brilliant history of Appalachia, Ramp Hollow, The Ordeal of Appalachia. Then, coastal property values are threatened by sea level rise.
There will be some kind of coastal property market correction. It could look different in different places, and it might come as a sharp decline in some cases. In other cases, it might be a slower decline, depending on how exposed the place is to the risk. But eventually, markets are going to catch up with the physical reality of this risk. And when that happens, that could be very, very calamitous for some places.
That's Rachel Cletus of the Union of Concerned Scientists. We talk with her about the report she co-authored, Underwater, Rising Seas, Chronic Floods, and the Implications for U.S. Coastal Real Estate. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon. The people of Appalachia have been alternately praised and despised. Praised as the embodiment of that traditional American icon, the self-reliant yeoman farmer. But they've also been despised as backward primitives who resist modern progress. Maybe the self-reliance and the resistance are both part of a way of life that has much to teach us. My guest Stephen Stoll's book, Ramp Hollow, offers a fresh, provocative account of Appalachia and why it matters. Stoll tells a story of the region as a complex struggle between mountaineers and profit-seeking forces from outside. Drawing powerful connections between Appalachia and other agrarian societies around the world, Stoll demonstrates the vitality of a peasant way of life that mixes farming with commerce but isn't dominated by a market mindset. Stephen Stoll is professor of history at Fordham University in New York. Stephen Stoll, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you.
You write in your book, Ramp Hollow, that you're interested in how people get kicked off the land and why we don't talk about them. It centers on basically the dispossession of the people of West Virginia, the settlers of West Virginia, of their land and the industrialization of the landscape by the coal companies. And you start out the book talking about the collision between an agrarian economy and a capitalist economy as being kind of that central struggle. What do you mean first by an agrarian economy?
We tell all these stories about ourselves and our origins as a society. And, you know, people don't like to tell stories about themselves that are embarrassing or reveal some flaw that they have, right? Well, we do this as a society that has capitalism as its primary operating system. And one of the things that capitalism is really good at doing is erasing all of the social and economic forms that it depends on and that preceded it. So the odd thing to me as a historian is that people who produced their own commodities, their own food, sold whatever they wanted to sell to other people or exchanged it, and then went back and continually created those very same commodities for their families and for exchange. That is the way that most of the people who have ever lived, lived. In fact, until 200 years ago, until even more recently than that, the vast majority of people on the planet live that way. But we tend to see this thing that we call modernity as just normal, as natural, as something that is kind of a human default, and it's not. So an agrarian society is one that I just described. And the awkward thing about telling the history of capitalism is that it depends on those people losing the wherewithal to produce those commodities and to have that economy. What they need to do is they have to abandon that land forcibly. The land has to go into production for capital, and they have to earn wages, which is also crucial for the creation of capital. So when that becomes the way that we look at the world, it becomes very difficult to resolve someone like a peasant as living in the present, as having a legitimate form of economy, as someone who shares the earth with us right now, maybe between 2 and 3 billion people, close to half, but in fact less than half of all the people in the world today are peasants, or that is to say, agrarians.
So what you're saying is that you have to have this dispossession under capitalism. In fact, at some point in the book, you say that capitalism is what creates poverty. So, and yet a lot of people think that capitalism lifts the agrarians out of poverty. So talk about the difference between a makeshift economy, like the economy of the Southern Mountains that you speak about in this book, Ramp Hollow, and you know, how capitalism comes in and, in fact, impoverishes them.
This is another part of the very same story that, again, as a society, we tell ourselves, and that is capitalism creates wealth and it makes life better. Capitalism does create wealth. It creates more wealth than any social system in human history. It creates an unbelievable, unprecedented degree of wealth. But it also doesn't distribute that wealth evenly, and as a shadow of itself, it creates even more poverty than wealth. Another thing that I found in looking into this story is that what we call poverty today is someone with no wherewithal, no land, or any other means of production in order for them to make for themselves a livelihood, is not something that existed before the 17th century. For the 1600s in England, you have the word pauper, which is someone who is abject poor, essentially homeless. No one in any peasant or agrarian society was poor like that. We may see them as poor, but I prefer to call what they had as being sufficient. Now, there are going to be people out there listening, and they're going to say this. He's romanticizing a peasant society. He is essentially projecting onto them all these values that he has. And what he wants desperately is to see them as superior to the way that we live right now. And that's not true, but it really suggests a problem that we have in looking at American Indians, hunter-gatherers, anybody who lived in a way different than the way we live. And that is, we really have two speeds. We see them as savages or we see them as noble savages. But that's not the way that we can understand them. Neither way of looking at them shows us who they were and how they lived. I don't romanticize them by calling them sufficient. Human beings would not have survived for those 10,000 years, and if we're talking hunter-gatherers, really 2 million years, were it not for the fact that their practices in their environments worked most of the time. Does it mean that they did not? They lived through all sorts of hardship? Of course they did. It doesn't mean that their lives were simple or easy. Not at all. It doesn't mean that they weren't subject to all kinds of natural forces. They were. But introducing that doesn't change the fact that what they had was a basic form of sufficiency that in certain times and places allowed them to flourish. Did that answer your question?
Yes, it did. I mean, not only did it allow them to flourish, but it also allowed the natural environment to flourish. Isn't that true?
Well, not necessarily, but in order to live in this way, you do have to be a land manager. But that's not to say that people didn't make mistakes, that they didn't overhunt, overplant, have too many people in the same woods, which would cut down the amount of land that each household would have for hunting, gathering, farming, gardening. It doesn't mean any of that. But it does mean that people needed to manage common resources as best they could. And in the long run, they did.
So you spoke about people working in common. And one of the things you talk about is the forest commons of the people of Appalachia. You say that they were never poor until they lost the forest, their ecological base. Talk about that forest commons and what it gave them.
Every agrarian society needs what's called an ecological base. There's no fishing village without a fishery, right? An ecological base is a set of resources that people use, which they do not have to pay for. This, again, is completely averse to capitalism, in which the means of production always have a price. But agrarians don't pay for these things. They can't, because money is not the center of their concern. Their households, their villages are not designed, they're not organized to produce money, even if they actually do produce money. So an ecological base is this set of resources that has to be managed that people draw from. In Appalachia, that's a forest. And the forest is obviously land for gardens and farms, but it's all these other things as well that are equally part of the farm. So, for example, they're hunter-gatherers because in the spring, you've used up your winter stores, all the things that you've canned, you know, pickled and preserved for the winter. It's largely gone. You haven't been able to plant anything that's come up and fruited. So you go with your family into the woods and you collect all of these different plants, especially ramps, which is part of the title of the book. A ramp is an onion. It's a wild onion, sometimes called a bear onion. It's like a scallion, but it's a much fatter leaf and bulb. And these were prized. Now, someone would look at this and say, these people are scavenging in the woods. I mean, look how poor they are. They have to basically take onions off the forest floor and bring them back and eat them. That's how poor they are. That is not at all how they looked at themselves. Those onions and these forage foods were cherished. They were a special time of year. They were loved and adored. They threw feasts and dinners for everyone in honor of them. It was a spectacular moment to be able to come upon this vast field of wild food and be able to harvest it at the moment that you needed it. So the forest gave you that, and it gave you animals, for hunting. Early on in the 18th and early 19th century, there were elk, moose, bear, wild cats, all kinds of animals that these hunting people, and they had always been a hunting people, loved to hunt. But also they grazed their animals, their own domesticated animals in the woods, so that the woods produce wild and domesticated cattle, as an example. So, and the connection between all of this and money is that a lot of the things that you produced in the forest commons, like the cattle, you marched them to market and you turned them into money. They were money on the hoof. They were very rarely consumed at home. They were produced in order to provide cash. And agrarians very often will have a cash crop. If it's rubber tapping in Kalimantan, if it's a certain kind of variety of corn in the uplands of Mexico, they would produce a certain commodity entirely to be turned into money, because money allows them to participate in distant markets and to purchase things made far away.
And one of those products was, in fact, rye whiskey. Talk about the role that Alexander Hamilton plays in the whiskey rebellion, basically in the dispossession, in the bringing of the agrarians of these southern mountains into the capitalist, the money economy. And talk about the whiskey rebellion.
The whiskey rebellion is a complicated event. It's a much written about event. Very often we see George Washington and Alexander Hamilton in our history books and in our high school classes. They levy a tax. The people of the West say, we're not paying the tax. And they say, the federal government is at stake. We must go and enforce the tax. Otherwise, no one will follow any federal laws. That's not exactly what happened. The people did say they wouldn't pay the tax, but they did so after explaining to Hamilton over a series of years and to Congress, look, you're asking us to pay a tax in money. Number one, we don't have a lot of money. And secondly, we already pay local taxes, and a federal tax is unprecedented. There's never been a federal tax. In fact, Hamilton and Washington undoubtedly understood that the revolution itself was fought over the imposition of a tax that the colony said they could not pay. So the people of the mountains gently reminded them that leveling a tax in these situations was a very bad idea. They said, you might as well tax our bacon and our flour. You're taxing this thing, whiskey, which we absolutely need. Now, who needs whiskey? Well, no one needs whiskey to consume. What they needed was it was a commodity that they turned into money with such ease and such effect. Whiskey could be sold at a very great distance. It does not spoil on the road, in storage. So it had the stability of money itself. Hamilton understood this, and this is why he wanted to tax it. So what was going on in his mind? Briefly, Hamilton thought that in order to create one unified economy, and therefore a unified society, federal society, that everybody needed to give a portion of their labor and their land, the value they created in their economic activity, had to be collectible by the federal government in the form of taxes. He believed that's what made someone a citizen. So his imposition of the tax and his selection of these western counties, he could have taxed lawyers, he could have taxed buildings, he could have taxed so many other things. In fact, I saw a whole list that he came up with, right? Why did he choose the people of western Pennsylvania who he knew made whiskey? Because he thought that out there on the frontier, they were in danger of joining Spain, England. They were basically in danger of breaking off and becoming their own society, their own state. That wasn't going to happen. But his tax was social engineering in order to bring them inside a monetary economy, because he was a genius and he understood that a nation is not defined only by its political boundaries, but also by the reach and extent of its roads and infrastructure, and therefore its economic relations. That is why he imposed it and why he felt that the federal government's existence depended on it. He basically said to them, I know that you don't have the money to pay the tax, but I'm going to level the tax and force you to get the money.
Now, another aspect that you go into in this book, Stephen Stahl, in this really fascinating book, Ramp Hollow, is that there was a basic contradiction in the way property was even conceived, that there was a two-tier system of property. Talk about that. Talk about the two-tier system and how that undermined, how that really led to the dispossession of so many of the people of this region.
Yeah, we think of private property. It's another story that we tell ourselves about capitalism. Private property has always existed, and private property is a very simple thing. You own it, you get to decide what you do with it. What's complicated about that? But private property is a human institution. It reflects the interests of people who are in power, and it's actually taken a number of different forms. So this story goes back to Washington and Hamilton, except it actually concerns George Washington, who was one of the largest landowners in what was then the West, which was the Southern Mountains, the Ohio Valley. He owned tens of thousands of acres. And like a lot of these landowners, he didn't do anything with it, and he didn't even visit this land, because Washington had no intention of moving his plantation to the Kanawha River, you know, in West Virginia. That wasn't going to happen. It didn't have any value. He couldn't sell it to anybody else because nobody else wanted it. He didn't buy it, by the way. He was granted it by the state of Virginia. So the story is that in his absence, and that of other major big landowners, that the Scots-Irish, Finnish, Swedish settlers moved into these mountains in the early 18th century to the mid-18th century, and they simply started to occupy the land. They occupied it, they wrote their own deeds, and they sold it and exchanged it with each other with absolute impunity. Did they know that George Washington owned this or that piece of land? They might have. They might have, and they didn't care. Or they might not have known who owned it, even if they suspected that someone like Robert Morris, another very big, even larger landowner, did own it. So they exchanged these deeds back and forth. When the industrial era began and another generation of landowners acquired that land, they found there were these competing claims. There were, as you said, two different land systems, both of them basically operating for at least a century. Judges essentially had to decide, when being confronted with these two different deeds, whose deed to honor in which circumstance. And for a long time, they actually honored, the judges, the mountain kind of handwritten homemade deeds. They actually honored them by saying, the big landowners never visited here, they never did anything with it, they sometimes didn't pay their local taxes. And these other people who live there have accumulated rights. That changed by the end of the 19th century, and judges were overwhelmingly ruling in favor of coal and lumber companies.
And there upon came the what you call the scramble for Appalachia, the whole industrialization. I lived in southeast West Virginia in Monroe County for several years, many years ago. And there was something, well, there still is something called mineral rights. I wonder if you could talk about mineral rights. I had never heard of this before, but it's a way in which the land you're on isn't really completely yours.
Right, that's right. Well, like I said, private property is not just one thing. It can take many different forms. And in fact, one's right to private property can be fractured in all sorts of different ways. What happened there was, it was really a kind of, it was a little bit of fraud, but it was really more like just a trick, where there was a landowner and he needed to kick all these people off of this land so he could sell it to the coal company and they could begin mining for coal. But he didn't want to take them all to court. It was going to be years and years of litigation in front of judges who might in fact end up ruling in favor of the mountain folk, right, and upholding their deeds. So he had an idea. He did not invent this, but he was the first person to use it, I think, in the United States. And that is, he went to them and he said, look, you can own the surface of the land. Your deed is sound. But what you're going to do is we're going to fracture this, your right, essentially, and split it. And the land underneath your land, the minerals under your land, I am going to buy a right to that. You're going to make some money because you're going to sell me that right. These people thought that they had made out like bandits. They thought, this is fantastic. We won because he's going to take something that we don't need, that we can't even see, that has nothing to do with our experience, and then he's going to allow us to stay on this land and not going to harass us anymore, and we're going to be able to live as we want to. And that's where the mineral right came from. What they did not understand in the fine print is that if the owner of the mineral rights wanted to exercise his right and remove those mineral rights, it would very often mean, the entrance of the mine might be right in the middle of that cabin. Or even if not, access to those minerals could, in fact, result in their having to leave altogether. It didn't always mean that. You could have a mining tunnel 2 miles below, a mile below the ground, where you're on top of it and you're fine. It didn't always mean that. But it could mean that. And they didn't understand what they were signing away.
You said before that the judges could possibly, rule in favor of the mountain folk, but that became less and less true. You've written in the book, Stephen Stahl, you wrote in Ramp Hollow, that perhaps no political leadership anywhere in the United States or the Atlantic world ever exposed its own people and environment to the same unbridled destruction and abuse. So talk about how the state and the courts rigged the system for industry.
I think the best way to understand West Virginia in the 19th and early 20th centuries is as a developing country, like a third world country. Many countries that we call late developing or third world countries or just the poor countries, they essentially have the labor of their own people and their natural resources. And an elite sets about essentially liquidating those in order to enrich itself, investing very little, if anything, in the people and in their common good. Well, this is exactly, that's all you need to know, essentially, about what the elite did. That elite was a merchant elite that was born in West Virginia. Many of them came from Wheeling, which a lot of West Virginians joke is not really West Virginia. There it is, wedged between Pennsylvania and Ohio, right? It's way up there. It was Unionist. And they're the ones who hatched the plan to have the western counties of Virginia secede from Virginia during the Civil War and form their own state, the only state to have been formed by seceding from another state. They did this in 1863. It was recognized by the Union, and they then had the control, the administrative control, over a state. Controlling a state gives you all kinds of privileges and power. You get to decide legally what goes on in that state. And a major motivation for forming that state was that those Wheeling merchants knew that the lowland planters wanted the iron, salt, lumber, and coal, even though it was third on the list in the 1860s. They were planning to seize all of those things with slave labor. The merchants wanted all that for themselves. So when they seized control of it, they set up a legal structure that was aimed, it was designed to welcome industry in order for that to be exploited. They weren't going to build the railroads. Some of them were railroad investors. They weren't going to mine the coal, even though many of them owned coal companies. They needed other capital from Baltimore, Philadelphia, New York to come in there and organize companies and make it happen. So they were serving the interests of those industries immediately after the war ended. And what I call the scramble began, the scramble for West Virginia or Appalachia.
The commodification of the landscape really led to the wholesale destruction of the environment. And this commodification, of course, is inherent in capitalism. Do you think that capitalism, just as capitalism creates poverty, that it perforce creates environmental destruction?
Yeah. Yeah. And in saying that, I don't mean to, for your listeners, I don't mean to condemn, you know, everybody who's involved in it. That might sound odd, but a lot of people are engaged in enterprises having to do with the core of capitalism, and they mean well by it. They're part of a system that they cannot control. And yes, it's true. Capitalism cannot take into consideration the destruction it causes. That destruction cannot have a price that is then factored into the price of the commodity, or the entire enterprise would collapse. There's no way it would make any money. We see this with like gasoline, where if we factored in the social and environmental costs of petroleum, a gallon of gas, you know, could cost $100. I'm making that up, but it would be far too much money. We proceed as though there is no social cost and there is no environmental cost, even though we know that it mounts. And then it becomes the public's problem, at public money, not private money, to take care of a lot of those problems. There are exceptions, of course, in which industry is held responsible. I know that. But in Appalachia, there is no doubt that there could be and there would be no such accounting for industry. They essentially could poison any river and still do. They could blow the top off of any mountain and destroy the valleys with all the debris, and they still do. They could use any kind of industrial chemical. And, of course, they could denude the entire region and take all of the wood off, billions of board feet of lumber during the 20th century. And that was fine because there was no such thing as ecological destruction as far as any of these entities, the state or industry, was concerned. That's another way in which it was behaving like a developing country. That was liquidating its ecological base. So it's not the way it is now. The forest is back, and there are lots of people in the mountains who have formed organizations against mountaintop removal mining, about restoring rivers. The people of Appalachia are not placid. They are not inert, and they are, many of them, activists. I've met them. They're extraordinarily well-informed and well-organized, and they intend to try to take that environment back, to get restitution from the coal companies and even get the land back from them in some cases. so we've not heard the end of this. And the end of the story is not the destruction of West Virginia. The end of the story has not been written.
And yet they did vote en masse for Donald Trump, who is supporting those very coal companies. Of course, many of them also voted for Bernie Sanders. So I wonder if you could just talk about the political landscape there and this contradiction.
Well, there are many people who know this better than I do, and my book is not about this, but it's perfectly fine to ask me. But this is what I would tell. Having been there a number of times and very recently, please, to all of your listeners, please don't call it Trump country. It's true that every single county in West Virginia voted for Donald Trump. That is true. But the greatest victory he won was about 60-40. So 40% of that county, 4 out of every 10 people, did not vote for Donald Trump. Another reason why Donald Trump won, though, was because there was very low voter turnout. Even those who did not vote for Donald Trump were not excited about Hillary Clinton. So there was extremely low voter turnout, which I'm hoping in the next set of elections, they're going to be much more activated to get to the polls. But I just want to say that Donald Trump won some counties near 50-50. So even though it has the reputation of an entire state voting for him every single county, in fact, there are many, many people, and I've met them, who did not vote for him and who have another vision of the country and of their region. So I would say that it's not Trump country. It's really country that's up for grabs. The state voted for Barack Obama in 2008 by about 8%. So let's not make up our minds what West Virginia is. It's up for grabs.
And you also say in your book, in Ramp Hollow, you say that Appalachia didn't have to turn out that way. What would be your counterfactual version of Appalachia now? I mean, how could Appalachia be different, let's say, if these folks do mobilize and take back their state?
The great failure, just to begin with the last election, again, the great failure of 2016 is the Democratic Party. The Democratic Party cannot be the party of urban, highly educated elites who drive up housing prices and force people out of the cities, who then take the public transportation back in order to serve them coffee. That can't be the basis of the Democratic Party. If it is not the party of the New Deal coalition, if it is not the party of industrial workers and the unemployed, then it's a goner. So my counterfactual for Appalachia would have been a Democratic Party that assembled that coalition, that was serious about the redistribution of wealth and public investment in infrastructure. Well, very much like Bernie Sanders wanted, and Bernie Sanders won the primary there. He won a number of different counties there and probably would have beaten Donald Trump in West Virginia, I would say. So my counterfactual is that West Virginia elected Bernie Sanders. Now, what will West Virginia become? Well, there's a lot of people there thinking about it, and, you know, it's really not clear. It's been the kind of peripheral fountain of wealth for corporations for so long that it never had the chance to develop an economy that was diversified, that was under the control of its own people, whose elected officials ignored them, utterly ignored them, for decades and decades. So I'm not sure, but I would suggest a mixture of farming, a program that would allow people to go back to farming if they wanted to, with various industries. I would want to see it a more diverse and not extractive economy. You know, companies would have to be encouraged to come there. I don't believe in corporate saviors, but I also understand that people need jobs, and not everyone's going to want to become a farmer or can do that. So, yeah, I would want some companies that are, you know, non-polluting, responsible employers to come there. A massive investment in their education so that people have the education necessary to do those jobs, which right now they do not. That's what I see. People are going to leave. When the economy has degraded in the mountains, people have always left. They've left for jobs elsewhere. And unfortunately, we are going to see a depopulation probably of the region as well. There are more African-Americans, Mexican-Americans, and people other than Scots-Irish whites who live in the mountains now than ever before. So it's a more diverse population, which is a very good thing politically and socially for the mountains. So I don't know what's going to happen, but that's what I think should happen.
Well, maybe we can take a clue from the West Virginia teachers.
That's right, exactly, who have inspired teachers everywhere and labor unions everywhere by their wildcat strike. That was just amazing and really exciting.
Well, it's just been great to talk with you, Stephen Stoll. Your book is Ramp Hollow. It is just a fascinating read and a perspective that I don't think any other book about the region has really given us. So thanks so much for talking with us
here. Thank you very much.
Stephen Stoll is professor of history at Fordham University in New York. Read an excerpt from Ramp Hollow by going to writersvoice.net. Next up, a crash in coastal property values due to climate change? Stay tuned after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Hundreds of thousands of homes are at risk of chronic flooding due to sea level rise over the coming decades. But long before those homes go underwater physically, many will go underwater on their mortgages. That's because coastal property values will plummet as the myriad effects of climate change and sea level rise become more and more evident. These and other impacts on real estate of sea level rise are revealed in a recent report by the Union of Concerned Scientists. It's titled Underwater, and I'm very glad to welcome co-author on the report, economist Rachel Cletus, to Writer's Voice.
Thank you so much for having me.
So this report, Underwater, from the Union of Concerned Scientists, I think I've been waiting for this report for a long time. It's been several years that I have told folks, you know, sea level rise is going to hit us before we think it's hitting us. And that's very much what this report is about. It's about the economic impacts of the risks of sea level rise as well as the actual sea level rise. Tell us kind of the overall arching purpose of the study.
Well, what we did with this study is we looked at the impacts of accelerating sea level rise in the contiguous U.S., the lower 48 states. And what we found is that sea level rise is accelerating, and it's driven primarily by climate change. And what's happening is we're seeing high tides become more frequent, reaching further inland. Tides are essentially inching higher, and it's this frequent disruptive high tide flooding that's sort of the first sign of the impacts of sea level rise. Well before places go underwater, they're going to start seeing this worsening chronic disruptive flooding. And our study focused specifically on the impacts on properties, homes and commercial properties along the coastline. What we found was that within the next 30 years, within the lifetime of a typical mortgage issued today, more than 300,000 coastal homes with a collective market value today of nearly $118 billion are at risk of chronic high tide flooding.
And you picked the high scenario level for sea level rise. Tell us what that high scenario is.
Our sea level rise scenarios come from NOAA scenarios that were developed for the 2014 National Climate Assessment. And what's important to recognize is that those scenarios, we're on track now for some of the high end of those scenarios. And the reason we picked the high scenario was that we are looking at people's homes, something that's obviously very, very important to people's financial and general well-being. And in those cases, what's advised is to pick a scenario that goes to the most risk-averse end of the spectrum, which is why we picked this high scenario. We also looked at a lower scenario of if the world were to stick to the long-term temperature goals of the Paris Agreement and if land-based ice loss was limited. And that scenario shows us that we can actually limit the harms done by chronic high tide flooding.
By 80%, is that right?
Yes. What's really important to recognize is that we do still have choices, and one of the most important choices we have available to us is making deep cuts in emissions. And if we do that in line with the long-term temperature targets of the Paris Agreement, and if land-based ice loss is limited, we can avert up to 80 to 85% of the damage from chronic inundation to coastal properties. So this is all very sobering. And what's key to remember is a lot of the sea level rise that we're going to see through 2045, through mid-century, is essentially baked in based on our past and current emissions. So those are the risks that we know we have a very strong probability of facing. And those are the near-term risks that we also point out in our study that communities around the U.S. have to prepare for, regardless of what happens to our emissions trajectory.
So the 80 to 85% reduction you're really talking about by the end of the century, but we already have the figures that you have in this study underwater is already pretty baked in for 2045.
Yeah, our study has estimates for coastal property at risk of chronic inundation in 2045 and then through the end of the century. Through 2045, unfortunately, we are on course for almost all of that being realized. It's towards the end of the century that we start to see some real potential to limit the losses, up to 80 to 85% potential of limiting the losses if we limit sea level rise.
So now, the report also does not include infrastructure, roads and, you know, power plants and things of that kind. It really just covers residential and commercial coastal properties. Why did you not include infrastructure?
For our study, we used sea level rise projections and looked at chronic inundation. We also used a property layer data set from Zillow, and that's what allowed us to get at the properties at risk. Now, we didn't have the data to do a thorough investigation of infrastructure at risk along our coastline. There's both public and private infrastructure at play. So that's not a data layer that we were able to integrate in this version of our study. But it is important to recognize that there's a lot of stuff on our coastline in addition to properties. There's infrastructure, there's places of great importance from a cultural heritage point of view. There are a lot of ecosystems at risk. And so there is a lot along our coast that's at stake as sea level rises. And so in a sense, our study is just the tip of the iceberg in terms of the cost to our economy and our society.
Right. And you really talk about the kind of interconnectedness, the domino effect, we could say, is one thing happens and another leads to another. Well, let's first talk about the decrease, how the decrease in coastal property values occurs. The report says a property market correction is inevitable, but right now the risk of sea level rise is not being factored in. Talk about the barriers to factoring in the actual risk and when those barriers begin to fall.
Yeah, unfortunately, for the most part, our coastal real estate markets are not really taking this looming risk into account currently. We've got a lot of short-sighted policies and market incentives that are continuing to encourage risky development, mask the risk to homeowners and communities, and essentially leave us less prepared to deal with this challenge. In fact, in many cases, we're finding that more development is happening on the coastline. If you look at Miami, for example, even as we know that these risks are coming our way, we're putting more property and people in harm's way. So we really have to be clear-eyed about these risks and take a different approach. Otherwise, essentially what we see unfolding, and we had a lot of conversations with market experts as well who recognize this as a significant risk, is that there will be some kind of coastal property market correction. It could look different in different places, and it might come as a sharp decline in some cases. In other cases, it might be a slower decline depending on how exposed the place is to the risk. But eventually, markets are going to catch up with the physical reality of this risk. And when that happens, that could be very, very calamitous for some places. It could trigger local housing market crises. Those could become even more widespread. because many people have a financial stake in coastal real estate. There's, of course, homeowners first and foremost, but then communities where these homes are located could find that as property values decline, they start to have a lot of their property tax base at risk. So, for example, in our study, we find that the properties at risk by 2045 contribute nearly $1.5 billion towards today's property tax base. So all of that could be at risk. And that property tax base is used to fund vital local services and infrastructure, so communities could suffer as a result. And then there could be more widespread repercussions because there are mortgage lenders who might find now that mortgages are at risk. There are coastal property developers, insurers, and even the taxpayer who ultimately could be on the hook for some of these costs. So the potential implications are pretty widespread.
You're listening to Writer's Voice, and we're talking with economist Rachel Cletus of the Union of Concerned Scientists about the report she co-authored, Underwater, Rising Seas, Chronic Floods, and the Implications for U.S. Coastal Real Estate. So property values of, let's say, take our own area here where I'm speaking to you from, the east end of Long Island. We have some of our most expensive properties, you know, multi-million dollar properties that are right on the water. Beachfront property, that's what people want. Those pay, you know, a large amount of taxes. And they go down. And now the taxes are less. And the money to fund local needs is now less, which makes the community even less desirable and makes the tax rate fall more heavily on those property owners who are left. Is that what you're talking about?
Absolutely. And this is not just about rich and expensive homes, of course. There are a lot of ordinary middle-class blue-collar folks who live along the coast, and they, too, have a lot of their financial well-being tied up in their home value. And as those home values decline, they stand to be at risk for great financial losses. As you point out, that area of Long Island is an area that's particularly at risk. In our study, we find that by 2045, the three counties that make up most of Long Island, Suffolk, Nassau, and Queens, could encompass nearly 15,000 homes at risk of chronic inundation. And today, there are about 40,000 people who live in those homes, and they're collectively valued today at $7.7 billion. So that's a lot of people, a lot of neighborhoods, a lot of value tied up in the coastal real estate market.
Yes, and it doesn't then only affect the people who live in those homes. I think it's important to reiterate, as you point out, but it's going to affect the community-wide.
Absolutely, because of the property tax base that's at risk, that can have real implications for the community. One other thing that we found was that community tax base at risk can also make it difficult for communities to raise money on the bond market, which they often turn to fund local infrastructure projects, but even for adaptation measures that communities might want to undertake. If their credit rating starts to slip in the bond market, that makes it even more difficult to raise money to do those kinds of vital things.
So now, business owners are also similarly at risk. Talk about some of the impacts to the local economy outside of the impact on homeowners.
So what we found is that there were a lot of instances where when we talked to financial sector experts, what they were telling us is that, look, these mortgages on these homes, because they're at risk from sea level rise, are inherently riskier. And that means that if this risk is flying under the radar, there may be people who are making these mortgage loans, banks that are making these mortgage loans, that aren't fully aware that these are risky mortgages. And unfortunately, in the case of properties that are at risk from sea level rise, unlike previous housing market crises where property values in most markets tend to rebound eventually, in this case, unfortunately, the property values will only continue to decline further as sea levels rise. And that means that many homeowners might have to make a tough decision to perhaps walk away from their mortgage once the home value declines much below the mortgage. And banks could be left holding the bag. And in that case, those banks, especially if they're small regional banks, might find a lot of their portfolio at risk. The other thing that might happen is that many of these mortgages are federally insured mortgages, in which case the taxpayer could also find themselves exposed should these mortgages start to go underwater.
Figuratively as well as literally underwater.
Absolutely. That is one of the ironies in this case. You know, a term that's used colloquially, underwater mortgages, actually is real in this case as sea levels rise.
Now, you spoke before of working class communities whose properties will also be at risk. Talk about some of the other vulnerable populations that people don't often think about. The impact of income inequality on a working class and poor communities of sea level rise.
Yeah, so there are many communities along our coastline, including in places like New Jersey and Massachusetts and Virginia, Maryland, where we found a 60% or more of the homes at risk within the next 30 years are valued below the state median. So these are ordinary people's homes, and they are at risk, again, from chronic inundation. Another thing we found is that there are nearly 175 communities around the country where 10% or more of their housing stock is at risk from chronic inundation. And of those, nearly 40% currently have poverty levels above the national average. So we're talking about places like coastal Louisiana, where there are very high poverty rates and there's a very high percentage of homes at risk. These are places that are going to have a disproportionate harm because people have even fewer resources to cope with the risks and the aftermath of chronic flooding.
And where I live here on the East End is largely it's an aging community, perhaps like a lot of resort communities. People are living on fixed incomes. Talk about the impact on elders who may be particularly vulnerable to this kind of economic impact of sea level rise.
Yes, there are a number of places which have a high elderly population. These are people who live on fixed incomes who have a lot of their wealth tied up in the value of their homes and are relying on that to be able to fund their needs whether they're medical needs or just basic needs, and don't have a lot of other avenues for income. And for people at that stage in their life to take a big financial hit, like losing a big chunk of their property value, could be devastating. And there are places like this, as you point out, where you live. There are also places, for example, on the eastern shore of Maryland, where there is a very high percentage of elderly African-American population that really is even now, not even in the future, but right now, today, experiencing chronic high tide flooding. They've had places where septic tank systems have failed because of saltwater intrusion, and that makes it practically impossible to sell a home. And this is very, very difficult for these isolated rural communities in the eastern shore of Maryland.
Now, talk about what are some of the government policies, market incentives, and investment landscapes that prop up the business-as-usual choices and that don't account for sea level rise. You know, I have a friend, for example, who has a beautiful house on the bay, you know, beautiful view. And you know, I said to him, "You're such a lucky man to live here." And he said, "Yes, I am." And I said, "But are you concerned about sea level rise?" He said, "Oh, well, that's going to happen later on." You know, so people are not really thinking about this. What are some of the policies and market incentives that keep people from thinking about that?
Well, first and foremost, of course, there's a big draw to living along the coast. This is a very long-standing draw around the world and in the U.S. for a variety of reasons, both cultural and economic. Coastlines are the places that we've developed the most, have a lot of people and property here. But what's happening now in light of sea level rise is we really have to take a fresh look at the choices we're making. And unfortunately, we have a lot of well-intentioned policies as well as market incentives that are distorting people's perception of the risk and are perpetuating risky development and sometimes rebuilding in the wake of storms and disasters, right exactly where things were. So this business as usual approach to our coastal economies and living really has to change. And to do that, we're going to have to reorient some of these policies and market incentives. The biggest problem we see is that most people don't know the risk and they don't know how near-term the risk is. So we hope our research will help move the dial on that, but it's really critical for homeowners and communities and policymakers and financial sector actors to inform themselves of the risk. We need updated flood risk maps that actually reflect future conditions, including projections of sea level rise. That's not the case for current FEMA flood risk maps, for example. We need more investments ahead of time, not just post-disaster, but ahead of time in flood reduction measures. And we need to make sure that in the aftermath of disasters, the money that we're spending is spent wisely and it helps build resilience rather than just put people right back where they were. We've got to have better systems of disclosure in real estate transactions and other market transactions so that in the course of buying a home, for example, you're more aware of the risks that you face. We have to reform our national flood insurance program so that we're not just continuing to make payouts in places that are highly exposed to risk, that we're also incentivizing voluntary home buyout programs in some of these high-risk areas, that we're helping people invest in flood-proofing measures, both individually as homeowners, but also as communities, and that we're safeguarding our natural environment, things like wetlands and marshes and barrier islands that serve as natural protections against things like storm surge.
Well, that's a great place to end. Dr. Rachel Cletus, you are an economist and a climate change expert with the Union of Concerned Scientists. Thank you so much for talking with us here on Writer's Voice.
Thank you so much for having me.
Rachel Cletus is an economist with the Union of Concerned Scientists. Go to writersvoice.net for a link to the full report, Underwater. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. And follow us on Twitter at writersvoice, all one word. Then check out my blog, Francesca Rhiannon at blogspot.com. You can find lots of cool stuff there. The Writer's Voice webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.